All right, 1 Samuel chapters 4 and 5. In those days the Philistines mustered for war against Israel, and Israel went out to battle against them. They encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Aphek. The Philistines drew up in line against Israel, and when the battle was joined, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. When the troops came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord put us to rout today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, so that he may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh and brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim. The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. When the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout so that the earth resounded. When the Philistines heard the noise of the shouting, they said, "What does this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" When they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come to the camp, the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "Gods have come into the camp." They also said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, in order not to become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight." So the Philistines fought. Israel was defeated, and they fled, everyone to his home. There was a very great slaughter, for there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. The Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. A man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh the same day, with his clothes torn and with earth upon his head. When he arrived, Eli was sitting upon his seat by the road watching, for his heart trembled for the Ark of God. When the man came into the city and told the news, all the city cried out. When Eli heard the sound of the outcry, he said, "What is this uproar?" Then the man came quickly and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were set so that he could not see. The man said to Eli, "I have just come from the battle. I fled from the battle today." He said, "How did it go, my son?" The messenger replied, "Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has also been a great slaughter among the troops. Your two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured." When he mentioned the Ark of God, Eli fell over backward from his seat by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died, for he was an old man and heavy. He had judged Israel 40 years. Now his daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant, about to give birth, when she heard the news that the Ark of God was captured and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead. She bowed and gave birth, for her labor pains overwhelmed her. As she was about to die, the women attending her said, "Do not be afraid, for you have borne a son." But she did not answer or give heed. She named the child Ichabod, meaning, "The glory has departed from Israel," because the Ark of God had been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her husband. She said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the Ark of God has been captured." When the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and placed it beside Dagon. When the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, there was Dagon, fallen on his face to the ground before the Ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. But when they rose early on the next morning, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the Ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off upon the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. This is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not step on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. The hand of the Lord was heavy upon the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and struck them with tumors, both in Ashdod and in its territory. And when the inhabitants of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, "The Ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is heavy on us and on our god Dagon." So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines, and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel?" The inhabitants of Gath replied, "Let the ark of God be moved on to us." So they moved the ark of the God of Israel to Gath. But after they had brought it to Gath, the hand of the Lord was against the city, causing a very great panic. He struck the inhabitants of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. So they sent the ark of the God of Israel to Ekron. But when the ark of God came to Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, "Why have they brought around to us the ark of the God of Israel to kill us and our people?" They sent therefore and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, "Send away the ark of the God of Israel and let it return to its own place, that it may not kill us and our people." For there was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of God was very heavy there. Those who did not die were stricken with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. The word of the Lord. Okay. So the Philistines occupied a territory that today we would call Gaza. It was along the Mediterranean coast to the west of the territory of Israel. And really throughout the Old Testament, the Philistines are the principal enemy of Israel. And battles between tribes and nations back then involved much more than the loss of territory or treasure, loss of prestige or lives. When you lost in a battle, essentially you became subordinate and enslaved to the people who were the victors. And of course we see this most clearly in the story of David and Goliath. They're getting ready to fight another big battle, and they decide to settle it through single combat with champions. That way, even the victor wouldn't have to suffer heavy losses. And the deal was, if Goliath kills David, the Israelites become the slaves of the Philistines, and if David kills Goliath, then the opposite happens. So this was not what a lost battle would mean to us. The consequences would have been much more severe. And there were theological implications, because if you go into battle and you lose, then you have to start asking yourself, why did God let us down? Is our God really the God we thought he was? Is their God better than our God? Have we been worshiping the wrong God? Okay. Now, we don't know exactly where Ebenezer is. Somewhere 20 miles to the east of Shiloh, and there's two battles. Israel loses the first one, losing about 4,000 people. That could be accurate. It's not beyond the realm of possibility that it's accurate, but as we've seen, when it comes to numbers, the Old Testament often exaggerates to sort of magnify the gravity of the situation. Another possibility that fascinated me as I was studying commentaries was that the Hebrew word thousand could have been a euphemism for a military unit that was much smaller. And that, so when you're looking at maybe 4,000 being killed, what that refers to is like 4,000 platoons being wiped out. So that the losses would have actually been in the hundreds rather than in the thousands. Either way, they lost. And after they got beat, they said, you know what we need? We need the Ark of the Covenant. Now, of course, why didn't they think of that before? Consistently throughout Joshua in particular, when they bring the Ark of the Covenant into battle, they win. In fact, MacArthur, who wrote the Anchor Bible commentary on 1 Samuel, wrote, "The primary importance of the Ark, as conceived in these accounts, is military, and its presence in battle is regarded as essential. Without it, victory is impossible." And then he cites Numbers chapter 14, verse 44. And that quotation and citation is in your notes. And so, in a way, it was arrogant for them to think that they could beat the Philistines by themselves. And it just shows how the corruption has filtered down from Hophni and Phinehas into the people that they serve. You know, when you have corrupt leadership, it's gonna leach down into the populace, and everybody's gonna start to think themselves immune and invulnerable. So they say, "Well, let's try this again with the ark." So they send for the ark, and it comes into the camp, and they go wild. Okay, think rock star taking the stage. I mean, and it's so loud that the Philistines, you know, camped, I don't know, probably a mile or two away, hear it. And they're like, what's going on over there? So it seems like they sent a recon unit to find out what was going on in the camp. I mean, cheering is not something you expect from an army whose butt you just whipped. And so they see the ark, and they get the report, and they are terrified because they've heard the stories. They know what the ark is. They know what the ark can do. They know how God led the Israelites out of their enslavement to Pharaoh in Egypt, and now they're facing up against this God. Now, in your translation, it may render it as it does in mine, gods have come into the camp. Again, we've talked before in the introduction about how the text we have of Samuel and Kings, the eldest manuscripts we have do not agree with each other. And it's hard to determine for this, that, or the other, which one's more reliable. So it's a kind of a 6-5 and pick 'em kind of thing. So your translation may have God rendered in the singular. But if it's in the plural, what this does reflect is a misunderstanding among the Philistines. They knew some, but they didn't know all. And in those days, the Israelites were really the only monolatrous people, with maybe a few exceptions. You could argue that during some dynasties in Egypt, they were sort of kind of monolatrous. So the Philistines would have ascribed to the Israelites the same principle that held for veritably everyone else, that they worship multiple gods. And it's interesting that, you know, here they are shaken in their boots, and then in verse 9, you know, they just sort of suck it up. Take courage and be men, O Philistines. You know, that was quick. They go into battle again, and this time the slaughter is even worse, 30,000 soldiers. Among the dead are Eli's sons, which is a fulfillment of the prophecy that was given to Eli in chapter 2, verse 34. And they capture the ark. And there are two just devastating theological problems. One, they took the ark into battle and lost. That was not supposed to happen. So then the question is twofold. Why wasn't God with us? Has he abandoned us? And the second question is even worse. Could it be that the Philistine gods are more powerful than Yahweh? Yeah. I mean, uncharted territory. I mean, questioning everything that you and your ancestors have believed for generations. And, the capture of religious artifacts, that was a way of defining the completeness of an enemy's defeat. When the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem and destroyed the temple, they took away all of the sacred furniture. It was basically a way of saying, our God's better than your God because we won. A Benjamite runs back to Shiloh to tell the news. We don't know why it specifies it was a Benjaminite. It was a small tribe, but it does end up serving a sort of outsized role in the future history of Israel, specifically the monarchy. Eli's anxious for the Ark of God, the messenger comes in and shares the news. Eli's blind, so all he can hear is noise, and he can't quite tell what it's about. So he asks what's going on, and he's given a report of the battle and all the terrible things that happened. Eli's not so much upset about the defeat or all these people who died, including his sons. He's upset about the capture of the Ark of the Covenant, and he fell over backwards and broke his neck because he was old and, you know, heavy. You know, you would have think they could have left the body shaming out, because this guy, you know, he was just kind of an innocent rube, really. I mean, he wasn't a bad man. He was just an incapable and weak man. Humpty Dumpty went down. because, you know, if he's sitting like in a lawn chair, it's sort of hard to see how falling over could kill him. And so there's some little detailed hints in the text. At the gates of a city, you know, you have the walls, and then perpendicular to the walls are kind of these lintels, if you will, that frame the gate of the city. They're reinforced. And he's identified as a judge, which we'll get to in a minute. But judgment is done at the gates of the city. You know, this was happening in Jesus' time. You know, disputes and quarrels were resolved by a mediator, and they would sit on top of this wall that framed the gate. So he probably fell 6, 8, maybe 10 feet. Okay, so plenty to break your neck, especially if you're 98. And then, you know, sort of his epitaph is, he had judged Israel 40 years. It may say in your Bible 20 years. Again, it's which manuscript are you finding most reliable, and how are you going to translate the Hebrew? What's peculiar about this is that the role of judges was very distinct from the role of the priesthood. Okay, and now you see some overlap in the Old Testament between priesthood and prophet. Not a lot, but we certainly see it with Samuel, where he sort of starts out as a priest and then evolves into a prophet, and the role of priest is devolved onto other people. We think that basically this is a kind of a revisionist Deuteronomistic history, that basically from the time of Joshua straight through to the establishment of the monarchy under Saul, basically ascribed to everybody who played a prominent role in the life of the tribe and the nation as a judge. You know, in Judges chapter 12 and 13, you see a list of what's called minor judges. So, in a way, it doesn't really matter, but it's a curiosity that, you know, might as well address. So, chapter 4 ends with the story, after so much death and destruction, of the bringing of new life into the world, a birth, which you think would be a harbinger of hope. But that's certainly not how the mother saw this. She heard what had happened, that her husband was dead, Phinehas was dead, her father-in-law Eli is now dead, and she ends up dying in childbirth. The midwives are trying to comfort her with the news that she's born a son. She ignores them and names the child Ichabod, which is rendered here, "The glory has departed from Israel," but the literal translation from the Hebrew of Ichabod is, "Where is God's glory?" Which I think is even more poignant than the way that it's been rendered in our English translations. You know, her grief over the loss of the ark and the death of her relatives outweighs the joy of childbirth. And so this son, in a way, is a symbol that God's glory has departed, but also maybe a transitional point in that we'll see after this three-chapter sequence focused on the ark, we're going to see the prominence of Samuel as a prophet rise and the establishment of the monarchy. So basically, this corrupt Eliade priesthood, as prophesied, is passing away, and a new thing is about to happen. A new reality will be born in Israel, because, you know, in a couple of chapters they're going to get the ark back. So, but she doesn't know that, so she dies unhappy with a guy who's got a name that had to get him beat up on the playground pretty hard.
Here's an aside. It was on Jeopardy last night.
Oh, Jeopardy.
The name, and I said, it's Ichabod.
Boy, Jeopardy spans the gambit.
Yeah.
Ichabod myth.
I'm not sure if we are told or not. I can't remember.
There's no account here of the baby dying.
Yeah.
Just the mother and father.
No, he appears to survive. One would infer that if the baby died, they would have included that, because that would have just magnified the symbolism of the story. Before we sort of transition from the people who lost the ark to the people who got the ark and got more than they bargained for. Yeah. So then going into 5, the Philistines are pretty proud of themselves. They take the ark from Ebenezer to Ashdod, which is a city in their territory, just a few miles away from the coast. And the Philistines were sort of organized into 5 city-states, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gazagath, and Ekron. And they operated, for the most part, independently, though for things like war and other critical things, they would come together in council and unite, much in the same way that the 12 tribes of Israel did. And they take it into Dagon's house or temple, that sacred precincts where they kept their statue of Dagon, who we don't actually know a whole lot about, unfortunately. He was the principal god of the Philistines, but we just don't have a lot of mythology around him. The best that we can do is to glean that he was a fertility god that probably was associated with fishing. So, you know, you have your fertility gods that you go and sacrifice to so that your herds do good. And there are different gods in the polytheistic cult that you go to sacrifice to so that your wheat field does good. And apparently for these people living just a few miles from the coast, fishing would have been a major part of their economy and their sustenance. And so, it, to the best of our knowledge, Dagon was a fishy god. kind of in a mood today. And this is decaffeinated coffee, so just imagine.
No, it's regular.
Oh, it's regular. Oh, okay. Well, then it is all Peter's fault. So this is a humiliation for Yahweh, for the Ark of the Covenant to be brought into Dagon. It's kind of like he's the house guest, you know, but he doesn't belong there. They get up the next day, they go in, and Dagon has fallen. And, you know, if you can just imagine this, you got the ark in there, and you got the statue of Dagon probably up on some kind of pedestal, and he's just gone, he's just like fallen flat on his face. In a way, yeah, exactly, boing. In a way, in an act of obeisance to the ark, okay? So this is a sign that, contrary to the Philistines' expectation, that Yahweh still reigns supreme. So they pick Dagon up and put him back on his pedestal. It's okay, Dagon. We'll have a better day today. They go back the next morning, and Dagon's fallen again. This time he's been decapitated, and his hands have fallen off. Yeah, exactly. So and by this time, Dagon's wondering, why did you jerks bring this into my house? And they sort of kind of got the message, and there's this interesting verse 5 in chapter 5 where it's like, from that point forward, they would never step on the threshold of the temple, because that's where these body parts of Dagon were. They would literally jump over the threshold. So after this, you know, Dagon's been defeated, Yahweh's supremacy has been demonstrated. And then the people suffer from plagues. Now, it says tumors, and I think it actually was tumors. But, again, depending on the source, depending on your translation, some commentators think it's dysentery. But that doesn't make sense to me when you look at chapter 6, because when they want to send the ark back, they want to send it with a guilt offering, and they decide to send it, intriguingly, with 5 golden tumors and 5 golden mice. Why the mice? I mean, like, were mice Philistines? Was that like their mascot, Caroline?
Yeah. Mine says that this was bubonic plague.
That's exactly where I was going. It's an inference. It's an inference. Nothing that we can prove. But as you know, rats carry fleas that transmit bubonic plague, and bubonic plague is so known for these buboes or swellings that occur, especially under the armpits. And so the thought is that this was bubonic plague, and I think that's probably the best explanation.
My translation translates tumors as hemorrhoids.
Oh. Which is, well, yeah, because the word tumor is, the word tumor in Hebrew is very similar to the word but. And that's why some commentators think this was probably dysentery, but that doesn't explain the mice. And I don't know how you create golden images of dysentery. I don't even want to think about how that works. So let's go with bubonic plague. All in favor, say aye. All opposed, say I'm gross. And so the people in Ashdod are sort of like, okay, this definitely was a bad idea. We need to get rid of this. And so they have a little council. And the inhabitants of Gath, and interestingly, Gath, an ancient Canaanian, translates as stupid. Just kidding. The inhabitants of Gath said, we'll take it. We'll take it off your hands. And, you know, and I mean, that's, I can sort of see the logic to that. They're thinking these Ashdodites are overreacting. You know, this is just a coincidence. And this baby's made out of gold. And so we'll give it a good washing over.
Maybe they had a stronger god, they thought.
Yeah, I mean, for whatever reason, they bring it to Gath, and the same thing happens to them that happened to the people in Ashdod. I mean, panic breaks out, and so then they pass it along to Ekron. You know, as they're playing hot potato with the Ark of the Covenant. The people in Ekron, you know, realize what's been brought to them, they end up suffering. But before that detail's included in the narrative, they said, we have to get rid of this. And the only safe place to send it is back where it came from. We've heard the stories about how God afflicted the Egyptians with plagues, and now the same thing's happening to us. And yeah, maybe, you know, he didn't carry the day for them in the battle, but, you know, their God sure is taking a toll on us now. And so it's interesting the parallels you find between this and the Exodus, because God's principal purpose in the Exodus, if you remember from our study of that book last year, was not so much to liberate the Hebrews. That was, in essence, kind of a means to an end. God's purpose in these plagues was to demonstrate to Pharaoh and to all of the Egyptians the nature of his glory and his supremacy. And it was not until that was acknowledged that Pharaoh would let the people go. And so there's a causal sequence there. The recognition of God's glory and supremacy, then their release. And that's basically the same thing that's happening here from people who are familiar with the stories. MacArthur, I think, puts it clearly and succinctly in his commentary, the tale of Yahweh's vengeful rampage in captivity offered reassurance to the community. It contradicted the assumption that Yahweh might be humbled or spent by withholding his hand from the Philistines at Ebenezer. Yahweh had created an opportunity not only to remove his ark from Shiloh and its wicked priests, but also to demonstrate his power in the land of his enemies. And another commentary I'm consulting, Walter Brueggemann, he sees connections between this and the Song of Hannah, where, very similar to the Song of Mary, she talks about those who are exalted will be humbled and those who are humbled will be exalted. Well, he sees Yahweh demonstrating the truth of her song in the fact that he was supposedly humbled by his capture and captivity in the house of Dagon, where in fact he can't be humbled. The people who are being humbled are first the Israelites by their defeat, despite the presence of the ark, and then later the Philistines, who, despite their victory, lose. And the actor throughout this, this story is about God and the ark. You know, Samuel's gone. Eli and Phinehas and Hophni, they have a bit part. The woman who gives birth is anonymous. The Benjamite messenger is anonymous. You know, and so of all the characters, individual and corporate in the story, they're all superfluous relative to the ark. So this story is about God's presence with the ark, his glory.
I think the most favorite line from the Livakot that I have is, for he has spread the proud imagination of your hearts.
Yes.
Or minds. And the Israelites had really gone into battle without the ark, as you pointed out, were puffed up.
Yeah.
They were proud of their own standing and balance and all of that. So there's humility on both sides.
Yes. The dangers of pride, you know, and seeking after false glory.
Michael, how big is this ark?
The dimensions are given in Exodus. And I'm sure you've all seen the first Indiana Jones movie. You know, he goes down and it's a pit full of snakes. And they accurately rendered the ark in that movie. It was not nearly as big as this table. I can't remember. I think it's maybe like 4.5 feet wide, about 3 feet high, maybe 2.5 feet deep. And it had these two winged angels called cherubim, with their wings outstretched over the box, which is called the Ark of the Covenant because it is said to have contained the two tablets of the Ten Commandments that Moses brought down the mountain the second time.
And Aaron's rod and the magic carried around.
Correct, yeah. They had a lot of stuff in there. And there were rings on the four corners that you could slide these gold-plated rods in. And so you would kind of carry it around like a royal divan. You know, you've seen the.
It must have been gold-plated. Certainly, if it was gold, they wouldn't be able to pick it up.
Well, it was wood that was covered in gold, but it would have been very heavy. Yeah, I mean, a lot of gold, and the cherubim were solid gold, and you know, it's curious because, you know, you have this sort of arc, narrative arc. And then it sort of pops back into the picture when David brings it into Jerusalem. But then later on in the history of Israel, it just kind of disappears. And, yeah.
He says, mine says, it's 3.75 feet long by 2.25 high and 2.25 wide.
So I was a little off on that depth.
You were close, though.
I was close, yeah.
Yeah.
Score me a 92, A minus. Yeah, Janet.
Can you speak on that?
Hmm? Yeah, well, it was believed that God's presence dwelled on the ark and that the wings of the cherubim were basically the mercy seat of God because Moses and then the Aaronic priesthood would enter into the tabernacle to confer with God and to offer sacrifices on behalf of themselves and also on behalf of the people. And there were lots of different types of sacrifices. There were sacrifices of thanksgiving, but there were also sacrifices of atonement, where you're trying to repent of your sin and basically propitiate God through a blood sacrifice. And I think that there's a distinction to be made between the glory of God, His kavod, best rendered, I think, in the calling of Isaiah to the role of prophet in Isaiah chapter 6, verse 1 through 8, where it talks about the house of the temple being filled with smoke and the glory of God filling the temple. You know, in Exodus, Moses says to God, I'd like to be able to see you. And God says, that's not going to work out so well for you. So what I'll do is you basically put your nose in a corner. I'll stick my hand over you and pass you by. And then you can see my backside because that's all you can handle as a human being. Otherwise, you'd die. And so it wasn't believed that God himself was present there, but that the essence of God and his glory was there on the mercy seat. And so when you lose the ark, it doesn't mean that you can't pray to God. But this level of intimacy, the imminent presence of God on the ark, in the tabernacle, that's gone. You can't rebuild the ark because you can't replace the contents. And so this was abandonment, total abandonment. And it was called the mercy seat because that's what they were seeking from God. They were seeking forgiveness. They were seeking responses to their intercession for their needs. And they also used it as an opportunity to acknowledge the mercy of God by providing animal sacrifice. This was would not have been done on the ark. This would have been done on the altar. But the ark was present in the sacred precincts. So, I mean, most likely what happened to the ark was that the Nazis took it. No. Most likely what happened was that when the Babylonians sacked Jerusalem and destroyed the temple and took away all the stuff that was in the temple, presuming the ark was still there, they probably took it. And there's no indication that once David brought it into Jerusalem and then later on when Solomon built the temple, you know, the ark would have been ensconced there. There's no indication that it was destroyed or lost again. And so the thought is the Babylonians took it and probably destroyed it.
Melted it down.
Melted it down. Yeah, they probably melted it down. However, there's an Ethiopian Coptic church in Axum, Ethiopia, that claims to have the Ark of the Covenant. And they process it once a year, although people are pretty sure that it's actually a replica that they're processing. They keep it in a fairly well-fortified church, and there is a keeper of the Ark, one person, a priest whose sole responsibility is to tend the ark. And it's interesting in that these priests, with rare exception, end up with cataracts. That's one part of the story that I've found fascinating, and that's, you know, one of the few parts of the story that you can empirically observe and confirm. So you do have to wonder, you know, if it's not the ark, what do they have in there? And if it is the ark, why is it having this kind of effect? Because there are lots of speculation about what's in the ark and how it works and all that. And
they claim to have the contents of the ark. I mean, they got the whole enchilada.
They got the whole thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
interesting.
Yeah, you kind of think, you know, wouldn't it be cool to sort of, you know, put together like a SEAL team and just bust your way in there to find out what they've really got, but then you'd probably melt, you know. So
think of the Philistines.
Exactly. Whatever they might have been.
It's interesting to me that you talk about the Philistines being from Gaza and still the problem between people from Gaza and the Israelis, right, to this day. So.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can go back to the Balfour Declaration, which is celebrating its centennial, although I'm not sure there's a lot to celebrate, where they basically, you know, carved up the Ottoman Empire using straight lines without any regard to the ethnicity or religious, affinities of the peoples. That's how Iraq is such a mess. I mean, if they'd actually taken any care for the actual nations that were occupying that territory, they would have created three countries instead of one out of the territory of Iraq, and they would have drawn the eastern and western boundaries differently as well. That's in the past. But you really do have to go back to Joshua. Because the displacement of peoples didn't start in the wake of the Balfour Declaration. It didn't start with the creation of the State of Israel in 1948 by the United Nations. It started in Joshua and was going on before then. I mean, people have been jockeying for that patch of land from forever because it is probably the most strategically positioned piece of real estate in the entire world. It's the only place where three continents join together, and So major, major trading route. And then you start to link in this powerful religious experience that three major religions have had in that land. And we need to continue to work for some just settlement that will bring peace to the region. But it's hard for me to see how that will ever be possible.
Not until it's acknowledged that it belongs to the Lord.
Correct. Yeah. You know, and this is probably irreverent of me, but you know, in Revelation it talks about the city of Jerusalem, the heavenly Jerusalem, descending down, and you know, a lot of people think that you know, God's apocalyptic resolution will be to obliterate the earth so that heaven will remain, in a way kind of a more thorough version of the flood of Noah. But in fact, it appears that the earth will be restored to the perfection of God's original intention for creation. And there is this image of this heavenly city descending. And the image that I have is, you know, the only way that this will be settled is for this gigantic heavenly city to descend upon the Holy Land and basically just splat everybody and everything that's there. You know, kind of like the big foot that comes down in the Monty Python, you know, that's sort of, I know I may go to hell for that, but
sorry, isn't it interesting, I think you just told me this, but all the Catholics and the Copts and the Eastern Orthodox and us that are all fighting over it, and the key to the churches is held by a Muslim family.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Well, because they're neutral.
Yeah.
You know, some of you who have been to the Holy Land can probably speak to this better than I can, but it's infamous, the sacred sites, the Nativity and the Crucifixion and the empty tomb. Are fought over, and these churches are divided up among Roman Catholics and, you know, different aspects of the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Copts, and even the Anglicans get a little piece here and there. And fist fights have broken out over sweeping the floor. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's. Like, look at the wood floor here, okay, and just look at one of the lines, and the guy, you know, and that's the division point between, you know, what the Eastern Orthodox have and what the Roman Catholics have, and if you sweep over that line, somebody's going to get pretty angry about it, and I'm not sure this is what Jesus had in mind for us when he said in the Gospel of John, may they be one as you and I are one, speaking to God his Father, and much less one love one another as I've loved you, also from the Gospel of John. So there's this immense territoriality, and the reason because of it is because everybody who's got a piece of one of those sacred places thinks all the rest of them don't belong.
There is one Coptic priest on the roof of the Holy Sepulchre.
Mm-hmm.
The Coptics used to have the whole roof.
Yep.
But one day when the Coptics were off baptizing in the Jordan, I can't remember which sect it is that came in and took over the roof.
Took over the roof.
They had this battle. And so one priest, as long as one Coptic priest is in that community, they still have a claim.
Yeah. And as somebody mentioned earlier, I can't remember which one of the three principal sacred sites it is, but the key is held by a Muslim family.
That's
because
the sepulchre,
it's Holy Sepulchre, because they are a neutral party, and because none of the Christian sects trust each other with the keys. It's just heartbreaking. I mean, it's and ridiculous and shameful. I mean, think about the witness that professes to the world about, you know,
You know, if aliens came and they wanted to learn about Christianity and they said, well, the Holy Land would be a good place to start, you know, what they would come away with when they went back to Mars or wherever is, okay, so Christianity is a religion of envy and mutual hatred and suspicion. I mean, that would be the image they would get if they just went to these sacred sites.
Yeah. On Palm Sunday, there was an argument among the various sects within the Sepulchre, and they actually got into an argument of beating each other with pom-poms. It was on television.
I mean, it's... And we... All the more reason for us to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. And, you know, it's... you know, they have something called, I think it's called the Jerusalem Syndrome. And, you know, there is an energy to the place. A lot of people sort of get carried away. Sometimes they have messianic delusions. It's just the intensity of the experience. And that's for people who are making pilgrimages. And so I just have to do my best to refrain from judgment for people who live there and are sort of feeding off of this energy every moment of their lives.
It just occurred to me, why? I am the way I am.
Oh, boy.
Arthur says that I'm controlled, and they say, no, that's just because I'm right all the time. Maybe I'm under that influence. So
yeah.
Picking up tonight.
Yeah, that it is. We can dip into six if you want to, just to sort of finish off this arc in the narrative. I haven't given it a lot of reflection, but I mean, we can also keep working on four and five, and there's a lot there. Mm-hmm. You want to jump in? Oh, go ahead, Caroline. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was when you took over a god, okay, these polytheists, you know, it was kind of a more the merrier kind of thing. And the Romans were the same way. In fact, they're probably the best example. As they would conquer people, they would essentially adopt their gods. And, you know, they basically copied the Greek pantheon. You know, they bump into a people, beat them, and say, okay, sounds like a cool god. You know, just to be on the safe side, we'll worship and sacrifice to them too. You know, and you see this to a certain extent in Hinduism, except different. Hindus are, I think, badly misunderstood as polytheists, when in fact, you know, because they have all these different representations of God, and so people say, okay, so they've got all these different gods. In Hinduism, actually, these different representations, whether it's Vishnu or Ganesh or whatever, these are just all manifestations of God. So think about our understanding of the Trinity, like gone wild exponentially, and that's why converting people to Christianity in India is extremely difficult. Leslie Newbegin, an Anglican bishop who was a missionary, wrote in one of his books, he said, you know, the difficulty is that you tell people about Jesus Christ and you tell people about the Trinity in India, and the Hindus are like, well, that sounds wonderful. And it's just, you know, to them, another manifestation of God, but not one that's exclusive to all of the others that they've experienced. And so, you know, you pick up other people's gods. And for the Philistines, it'd be like, okay, Yahweh is one of our gods now. Obviously, Dagon is better because we were able to capture, you know, this representation, as they would have seen it, of this god of the Israelites. And so now he's our God now. Yeah, Peter.
I mean, our religion was guilty of that too, because that's why we had Christmas trees and ivy and...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we polished off Easter eggs and Easter bunny. I mean, we hopped on to a good few of local religions as we pressed.
We've done the same thing. Yeah, we would spread into different regions, and what we would do is we would co-opt the religious practices there. So, whether it was in the Germanic areas where they worshipped a tree god called Wotan, or Druids in Wales, what we would do is we would say, well, the trees aren't really gods. And here's where you're mistaken. The tree is a symbol of our God, in that the evergreen tree is a symbol of perpetual life, which is promised to us through Jesus Christ in his cross and resurrection. And so we'll use these trees when we celebrate the birth of our Savior as a way to symbolize that promise of everlasting life that entered into the world in the most unexpected of ways through this helpless infant. Easter is cited relative to Passover because of how those events are narrated in the Gospels. And it's usually in the spring where in pagan traditions there are fertility rites, which is why you have Easter bunnies and eggs. Because Easter bunnies are notoriously prolific, eggs are kind of like a chrysalis, if you will. I mean, they're a container of transformation, and the shell, sort of symbolic of the tomb, breaks open, and this new life emerges. To co-opt other religious traditions and to put a more positive spin on it, to translate, if you will, our understanding of God into terms that they can understand, we've sort of sewn these elements into our own tradition. Yeah.
I mean, and we'll have the big ceremony of the birth at the time of the winter solstice, by the way, just to make things.
Oh, yeah, no. Christmas was cited because we don't really know when Jesus was born. We don't even know the year, much less what time of year. It was cited on a couple of different festivals. Saturnalia occurs on the 26th. You've got the winter solstice, which happens on the 21st. You have my ordination of the priesthood on the 22nd. So what they're trying to do is, again, it's that Monty Python foot that comes down and sort of the cartoon transition that splats. We're just basically taking over other people's territory, reinterpreting their traditions to harmonize with our own as a way to draw them into the fellowship of the church. And I'm not sure that the decision was made in quite as intentional and mercenary type of fashion. I think there was a level of evolution in terms of saying he was born on December 25th of the Gregorian calendar. But I don't think you can deny that it's beyond coincidence that we would have selected that date for Christmas.
When you say, Michael, the tree is representative of everlasting life. Mm-hmm. And then right after Christmas, see all that everlasting life thrown out, on the ground and picked up,
Well, and, two things about that. One, we had to go to artificial trees when the kids were little because they're both allergic. And that killed me because, to me, that diminishes the symbol, because what you have is, a symbol of everlasting life, I suppose, but it's not alive and never has been, so it's fake everlasting life. But we pull her out of the attic and we put her together, and, I grit my teeth. And when I was in Virginia, I instituted a tradition that on the Epiphany, we would worship together to celebrate the conclusion of the 12 days of Christmas. And everybody would bring their wreaths and their Christmas trees. And we had an enormous fire pit. And we burned them. because that's what you do to sacred things. You either deconsecrate them or you burn them. And so like the oil that we use for baptism, the oil that we use for healing, you know, that it goes off after 3 or 4 years. So you can't pour it down the drain. And so what do? You set it on fire. And so when the oil goes off, you know, you kindle the first fire of Easter at the beginning of the Great Vigil of Easter. And that's what I do is I pour the oil out and stick the bottle in the first fire of Easter and light her up. And there you go. And so, you know, the symbol of the burning is it's the release of light in the darkness. And, you know, and because, as John said in his prologue, you know, light came into the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. And so that's a way of disposing of a Christmas tree in a way that honors its symbolism.
Maybe we should build a big fire pit and do our readings instead of throwing
them
into
the hams.
I would love it. And but I'll tell you what, you get yourself a 6 foot tall, 12 foot wide pile of dry evergreen, and you got yourself a big fire.
I mean,
we.
You can get permission from the fire department.
Yeah,
they can put it on the main road then.
Yeah, so we
camp out the fire.
Going back to the battles, just a curious question between the Philistines and the Jewish people. Do we know what kind of weapons they used? I mean, I know Charlton Heston had a chariot, and there were swords and spears.
Yeah.
Did they have bows and arrows, or do we have any idea of the weapons that they used?
I'll be honest, I'm not 100% sure. This would have been round about 11th century B.C., to the best of our knowledge. And obviously, there's evidence in Exodus that the Egyptians had chariots. That would have been considered advanced technology. And we do have a pretty clear concept of the type of weapons that the Philistines were using in the conflict between David and Goliath. So it's Bronze Age, do I have that right? We're sort of late Bronze Age, 11th century. And so these would have been fairly durable, strong weapons. We're talking swords, short swords, spears, certainly. I really don't know about bows and arrows. Does anybody here remember their college history well enough or high school history well enough to know whether bows and arrows were a thing? Slingshots, you know, that would have been pretty much your artillery. But it would have been close quarter fighting. It would have been nasty. And in terms of tactical deployments, it would have been pretty primitive. The Greeks and then later the Romans were able to achieve military success in large part because of the development of the phalanx, which is a very simple tactical deployment.
Romans had adapted their science, but in Masada, you can look down and see this triangular thing that they built.
Yeah.
That battle still exists to this day.
Well, and they had catapults and trebuchets and things like that, primitive but effective. A siege tower, they had siege towers, the Romans did. So this would have been, you know, not clubs. But these would have been fairly nice bronze weapons, and usually engagements would have been in the low four figures. You know, these were not nations that could field reasonable. I mean, you would have had to have basically had armies of tens of thousands just would not have worked. I mean, how do you even keep them fed?
Yeah, I wonder who funded those two. I mean, was there a national tax to build spears?
Well, before the monarchy, there was a tribal confederation. It was very loose. They would come together to cooperate with stuff like this, and there was probably a levy for every tribe. They had to, you know, meet a certain quota, not unlike state militias in the Civil War in the North. They would come together, and and fight. I don't recall a lot about the manner of military engagements in the period.
I don't think arrows, bows and arrows were present, otherwise the chariot wouldn't have been such a prize.
They had the arrows. Remember the story of David and Jonathan? When David was afraid of Saul and they made a covenant, like, okay, go to the New Moon Festival and figure out what your dad is, what his attitude is. Didn't he say shoot three arrows?
Yeah, I guess, I mean...
Not like artillery arrow, yeah. Maybe, but...
Well, they definitely, I guess, well, they had bows and arrows. I mean, you can look at the caves in Lusso and know that, you know, those were used for hunting. Whether they would have been considered military grade is what I don't know. Yeah. So, you know...
I mean, just if you just think back to the Battle of Agincourt, where they had the bows and arrows.
Yeah.
And the French cavalry was just decimated because you a good Welsh or English bowman could fire an arrow every 10 seconds and...
And,
and
longbows had great range, and basically, I mean, at their height of effectiveness, before they were superseded by firearms, bow and arrow was artillery, because you weren't firing them on a plane, you were firing them over distances, you know. Well, you've all probably seen Braveheart, you've seen how the archery was used in that. You'd basically soften people up. And then once the battle closed, they were done for the day because it'd be very easy for your own people to get hit by friendly fire. Whether the bow was adequately developed for use as a military weapon at the time, I don't know. I'll try to find out, and you know, maybe you guys can get online and do some research. And bow and arrow did equalize the battlefield when chariots were present because you could pick off the driver. Mm-hmm. What time is it? It's almost 11. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, Caroline.
I wanted to get back to the thing that you said about converting Hindus to Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that, the attempt of that up close in that there's a teacher at Jefferson Community College and who was hired and she was Hindu.
Mm-hmm.
And the person that hired her was a member of Southeast Christian,
mm-hmm.
and was constantly talking to her about Christ and everything. And we all had lunch together, and you know, did sometimes had dinner together and stuff. And, she was Trapiro was her name, and she was fascinated by mm-hmm. Jesus and just thought it was wonderful. You know, mm-hmm. and she was so effusive about everything that she was being told and everything, and just absolutely, the other woman thought that, you know, she was going to come to Southeast and mm-hmm. Start worshiping there. And we all had dinner one night at her home, and her husband was also Hindu, mm-hmm. and he said, well, now, let me, it was a new home, and so that we went and were looking at everything, and he said, and he opened the linen closet, and he had built a platform in there, and he said, and here's where we keep our gods.
Yeah.
and she said something now. Oh, and she couldn't wait to paste baby Jesus right in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh my
that's,
goodness.
That's. Yeah. I mean, that's.
And I'm standing here trying not to pass out and hoping that this woman for practice out Jesus is not going to fall over.
Yeah. I mean, it's.
But I mean, that was exactly the way you described
yeah.
it.
It
was.
What a marvelous experience, and I'm glad you shared the story. I mean, that's...
Going back to bow and arrow, uh-huh. The internet's unbelievable. They are using the arcus or bow and arrow for hunting and battle.
Yeah.
is of great antiquity. It's mentioned in Genesis 21:20. and is depicted, and the Iliad, the Odyssey, depicted in different monuments, series, and sculptures. The Philistines excelled in the art, which led David to order special training in it be given to the Hebrews, Samuel 1:18. An important art throughout the world in biblical times. So you'll be saying, look, the Benjamites among the Hebrews were noted as archers.
Okay, interesting.
In Genesis it says, Isaac, I'm now an old man and don't know the day of my death. Now then get your weapons, your quiver and bow.
Okay, excellent. So in fact, then bow and arrow were in military use. You know, I'd forgotten about the Iliad and the Odyssey because certainly, you know, the Trojans, you know, had remarkable archers and an easily defensible position to use them to great devastating effect against the Greeks. So, all right. So now we know the Philistines and the Israelites were plugging each other with wooden shafts and feathers on the back. So, see, I love it. You know, to come here to learn things, for this to be a true exchange of knowledge and wisdom among one another, and we give thanks for that. It's supposed to rain later today, so we do need to clear the tables and chairs for the preschool children to have some romper time in here instead of the playground. Why don't we say the Lord's Prayer together, and we'll meet next Wednesday. And if I don't see you between now and then, happy Thanksgiving to you, and safe travel if you're going to be on the road. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.